everybody. Welcome back to the Bold Sidebar. This is your host, Jeff Horn, talking all things New Jersey Supreme Court. Hopefully my enthusiasm and excitement punches through and that the logjam has been broken. A deal has been made in Trenton to move two Supreme Court justice nominees, Rachel Wehner Apter, who has been justice in waiting for about a year and a half, who comes out of Bergen County. And a deal was made with the senator and the governor and all the powers that be to move the nomination forward. You may recall she was nominated, the session ended, she was renominated here in 2022, and it seems that Rachel Wehner Apter will be moving forward to the Senate Judiciary Committee and to the Supreme Court by way of the advice and consent of the New Jersey Senate. It may take another month or so, but at least there's light at the end of the tunnel for our supposedly seven justice Supreme Court that's been operating on a skeleton crew for a lengthy period of time, including Judge Fuentes, who has been serving up from the appellate division in the Supreme Court, brought up by Chief Justice Ravner. You may also be aware that Chief Justice Ravner took the extraordinary step of elevating three other senior appellate division judges to serve on the Supreme Court to deal with what we can only imagine is a massive amount of work when you normally have seven justices with a full staff and you're down to four. So appellate division judge Douglas Facial, not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, appellate division judge Jack Sabatino, and appellate division judge Clarkson Fisher all are temporarily elevated to the Supreme Court so the court can get through its own backlog. I think the court has done a miraculous job over the past couple of years between essentially revamping how court is done in New Jersey during COVID and handling the caseload, still generating the 70, 80 opinions that the court generates every term. I will have Joe Fischetti back on to analyze those opinions and do his statistical dance for us and give us a lot of insight into what's gone on this past term. That's coming up here in the next few weeks. But importantly, in addition to being temporarily elevated, Judge Facial will also be nominated to fill a vacancy on a permanent basis. So that would bring the court back up to almost a full complement of justices. That will bring us to at least six justices. And then, the way I understand the tea leaves and reading the news, there will be another vacancy. Justice Solomon is pretty close to mandatory retirement and certainly has served in government and served as a judge long enough to retire early. If he retires early, that will create another two vacancies. So there may very well be an opportunity for Governor Murphy and the Senate to move two more justices who will serve for years into the future. So I've been hesitant to jump into this fray, but a lot of activity in the past couple of weeks. As I say, the temporary elevation of three well-regarded and senior appellate division judges, and now two nominees moving to the New Jersey Supreme Court. So that's fantastic. I'm going to leave it there on that topic. Hopefully the next conversation we have, or one or two more shows forward, will be the fact that we actually have the justices sitting and they've been through the Senate process and our vacancy problem will be down to perhaps one vacancy. I'm going to do three cases today. I'm a little backed up on cases, but I will do three that I'll describe more or less as civil cases. One is a politics case. I'll start with that. That's the Linden Democratic Committee versus the City of Linden. And it's interesting because there really does not seem to be much by way of partisanship in the dispute that gave rise to a case that went all the way to the New Jersey Supreme Court from a dispute that started back in 2017. It's sort of Democrats versus Democrats in the city of Linden. And our current Senate president, Nicholas Scutari, was at the time the chair of the Linden Democratic Committee. So here's what happened. The city of Linden is a strong mayor with a legislative body, a council of 10 wards. Ward 8 had a vacancy because the elected council person, Michelle Yamakaitis, was elevated to the council president, hence creating a vacancy and a dispute over whether the City of Linden governing body, the council, had to seat the selected replacement temporarily from the Democratic Party. The gentleman who was selected by the Democratic committee was Paul Coates Jr. He was selected to replace Yamakaitis for the 8th Ward. So Justice Albin, in a unanimous opinion, finds that the city council got it wrong. Here's how it went. The vacancy law has been amended numerous times. The 1990 version essentially breaks down like this. If a council seat becomes vacant and the person that had that seat was a member of a political party, the committee in the municipality for that party has the right to propose 3 nominees to sit in the seat until the next election, the next general election. So this would have resulted in Coates being seated for about 10 months prior to the next election, at which time he would have to run for re-election if he was desirous of keeping the slot. The Democratic committee sued the city and was successful at the trial court. The Chancery Court ordered that Coates be seated, ordered $110,000 in legal fee reimbursement, and found that the council had violated the statute. The statute is NJSA 40A:16. We'll speak a little bit about some of the subsections because there is a conflict in the subsections, literally getting down to interpreting the combination of the word may and hereinafter. In 16-5B, essentially says that the council may seat a replacement on a vacancy as hereinafter provided. Then we get into section 11 and 12 that addresses exactly what I was just saying. If the vacancy is created and the person was a member of a party, there's a procedure for that party to put up 3 nominees to the council. Then the council must select one of those 3. If the vacancy was from an elected council person who was not a part of a party, then the council is vested with discretion to leave the vacancy or to fill the vacancy. And hence where the dispute arose, the committee was successful in the Chancery Court. The appellate division reversed, interpreting the language differently. Justice Albin, writing for a unanimous court, found that in harmonizing the language of the different sections on the 1990 revision to the law, that it was clear that if a person was elected or was part of a party, that party has the right to put up the 3 nominees. And if the council then doesn't select among the 3 nominees, that the party itself has the right to select and seat a new council person. So as you can imagine, this was a hotly contested issue in the city of Linden and the council. Lots of words flying. Justice Albin, in part, relied upon the commentary on the bill coming out of the Senate committee. In the description of the bill, it stated specifically that the purpose of the bill, the 1990 revision, is to remove the discretion of the council to preserve the vacancy. So the aspect of the vacancy is resolved. The issue regarding council fees and the attendant civil rights action that had been adjudicated by the Chancery Court and had not been addressed specifically by the appellate division, because of course it was finding that the committee's claim was baseless, then the issue of council fees and the civil rights action is remanded to the appellate division. The policy here is clear. The people deserve to be represented, and when there's a vacancy, some effort should be made to follow the law and to fill a vacancy and get the people representation. So otherwise the people in the 8th Ward in Linden would be deprived of having a council member to address their issues. As the court system works, of course, they were deprived throughout, or at least for part of the period of the vacancy, because of the litigation. And here we are 5 years later. So obviously things have moved on in the city of Lynn. I always find irony when elected officials work hard to prevent vacancies from being filled. Obviously, people that are there got elected and now would use tricky legislative language interpretations to block their neighbors from having representation. I also get a sad kick out of sort of the government suing the government. So although the Democratic Committee is not the government per se, it's a legislatively honored part of the political process and had to sue its own government, in fact, its own party, to make its elected officials fill a seat and provide representation for their fellow city members. So anyway, I'll leave that irony to listeners to shake your head and wonder when people lose sight of what's important, that is democratic process, small d, I mean, get seats filled, get representation, and if those representatives are no good, chuck them out and try someone else the next time. Don't sort of have a construct a false wall to block the people from having representatives. Okay, off my soapbox, on to the new business rule. You may recall I spoke about this with Bruce Greenberg, who writes the preeminent blog regarding New Jersey appellate law blog. Easy to find, and I'm a steady reader of Bruce's many posts, so I highly recommend that if you haven't checked it out. And Bruce was right. I kind of think he was pointing us to the fact that the court was going to reverse to a new business recovering damages. So historically, we're talking back to Weiss v. Revenue Building and Loan Association, the Court of Errors and Appeals, 1936. So we're talking prior to the 47 Constitution. Always be wary when you're citing cases that predate the 47 Constitution. Don't forget, the Court of Errors and Appeals was not even populated entirely by lawyers. There were lay members, and although politics is always involved in the law and government and selection of judges and so forth, here, this was a more raw time in New Jersey politics. Put that to the side, the unanimous court, Justice Patterson, writing for the unanimous court, reverses Weiss for a, let's say, more reasonable view of whether a new business might recover damages in the lawsuit, even though there was a lack of a track record. So in this case, the plaintiff, Schwartz, was a new real estate developer and was going to develop two projects, one in Monroe Township and one in Egg Harbor Township. Neither project produced the fruit that he expected, and he felt like he was double-crossed by a number of players, including people that were going to develop with him, as well as legal counsel. And he initiated lawsuits, produced an expert report to demonstrate his economic losses. And in both cases, the Chancery Court barred his expert report. No expert report, no damages, no case. The appellate division affirmed in both instances and relied upon the Weiss precedent, that is, a new business cannot recover lost profits when the loss of profits is mere speculation. And again, this case has almost nothing to do with the substance of Schwartz's case. However, this litigation deals with a bar set fairly high for a claimant seeking lost profits from a new business. So the standard established by Justice Patterson is one of reasonableness, that lost profits may be recoverable if the plaintiff can establish with a reasonable degree of certainty that profits would have flowed but for the torts or breach of contract by the other side. Anticipated profits, however, are difficult to prove. And I don't think this blasts the door wide open for people coming in, making claims that they would have made vast sums when there's no track record for the business, or even in this case, for the developer. Schwartz had not been a developer before, had some business experience, but had not developed any substantial projects as he was doing here with these two properties in Monroe and Egg Harbor Township. So Schwartz is back in the game, got a chance to prove he would have made profits, notwithstanding the fact that he was a new business and that accepting his view, his efforts were thwarted by others who otherwise should have been aiding and helping him to succeed in the business ventures, the development ventures, and he would suggest had conflicts and worked against his success. One more. This is an insurance language interpretation case. Another unanimous opinion, this one penned by Judge Fuentes. It's Norman International versus Admiral Insurance Company. The underlying case is an employee of Home Depot named Colleen Lorito, who sued a company called Richfield Window Coverings. Richfield Window Coverings provides blinds and related materials to national retailers such as Home Depot, and provides the machines to cut the blinds to custom sizes. Admiral is an insurance company that provided general liability insurance to Richfield. Lorito was operating one of Richfield's machines in the Home Depot in Nassau County, New York. Admiral had in its policy a specific exclusion that it would not cover claims related to activities in certain New York counties, including Nassau County, related to. And Judge Fuentes, in the opinion, aggregated prior commentary in opinions that related to is broader than arising out of. So for those who write insurance policies, it's probably good to know that if you're looking to exclude coverage, related to is broader than arising out of. For all of us drafters, a good little tip. The trial court in the case found that Admiral did not have to defend, that the exclusion for activities related to, I should say related to activities in Nassau County, was straightforward and unambiguous and broad, and therefore there would be no coverage. The appellate division reversed and stated that the general rule is you lay the complaint aside alongside the policy in interpreting whether an insurer has a duty to defend. And it is always the insurer's, carrier's duty, or burden, I should say, it's the carrier's burden to demonstrate that it would not have a duty to defend its insured. The issue is the causal link. The appellate division found that there was an absence of a causal link between the four corners of the Lorito complaint and the activities of Richfield, the insured, the window covering supplier. Judge Fuentes digs a little deeper and suggests that it's the obligation of the court to interpret the actual activities. So, for example, Lorito's complaint may not have made reference to the extent that Richfield operates in Nassau County. Richfield, in seeking coverage from Admiral, simply said, we would sell products to Home Depot and other national retailers, and then it's really up to them where they deploy the materials and equipment. Well, that wasn't exactly the whole story, because Richfield would go to the stores, including the store in Nassau County, and repair the machines and so forth. So Richfield clearly had operations in Nassau County. The deployment of the machines in the excluded county just requires a little more analysis, a little digging, a little verification of what was actually happening. And since the policy was unambiguous, broad, clear, stating they would not, Admiral would not provide any coverage for operations related to the use of the equipment, use of materials, any sort of claims in Nassau County that the exclusion was unrelated to any causal link between Laredo's injuries and Richfield's operations. You can hear the wheels grinding for people that write policies, people that write contracts, and making sure that these contracts are tight. If you want to exclude something, find the way to blend in the phrase related to as much as possible, and perhaps using the term causal link as a further way to avoid running back to the New Jersey Supreme Court, as Admiral had to do to get relief from its exclusionary clause in the liability policy. All right, that's it for now. A few more cases lined up. I'm Joe Vachetti coming back, and we'll be excited to fill these vacancies. And see you next time on the Bold Sidebar. Thanks for listening.